least a few feet. Because it's further away from the center of the Earth, it will run faster. These are clocks that are accurate to 17 decimal places. And you can easily see the drift in the phase angle, so to speak, between the two clocks. So things further away from the Earth, a clock will run faster. The clock thinks it's running at the exact same time. Also, because things in orbit are moving at 10,000 miles an hour or something like that, there's also another shift because of the velocity. So the people running the global positioning satellites have to do a whole bunch of compensating, very small numbers, but the compensating is due to these two effects. I bet you've got some more information on this one, Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Well, yeah, it's a complicated thing, and it goes way back to Einstein's theory of relativity, that as far as equivalency is concerned, there is absolutely no difference between acceleration and being in a gravitational field. In other words, if I put Joe in a box, and I accelerated Joe up into space at the same speed that gravity accelerates down, he wouldn't know the difference. And there's no way for him to bring any lab equipment that would tell the difference in that box. It all feels the same. So as far as gravitational fields go, it's the same as being accelerated. And so you have time dilation, and it's a mess. But it's one of the 10,000 different ways that Einstein's theory has been proved, and again and again and again. And it's great that after more than 100 years, the darn thing just keeps on proving itself.
Question related to that, like you said initially, Dick, if you take a clock and move it a few feet above the ground or above the Earth compared to a clock on the ground, it'll run slightly faster. Is the difference in distance equivalent to like the speed of light in that distance?
No. Because you've moved it, yes, it's a further distance away from your instrumentation, maybe. Or you can put a cable on it and the cable bends. There's no change in the length of the cable. But when it's at the higher altitude, it's running faster forever. It's accumulating more cycles per second forever at the higher altitude. So the distance that you moved is, I don't think, the factor. The fact that you're further away from the center of gravity of the Earth, that's the factor. Do you see it that way, Roy? AC2GS, K2IW.
Yeah, gravity works the same way electromagnetism, inverse square rule. So you keep, you know, if you go farther and farther from the Earth and you get a scale and you put yourself on the scale, you're going to weigh less and less and less as you go further and further up. And this decreased gravitational field is causing less and less time dilation. The strongest time dilation is on the ground, and the weakest time dilation is as high above the Earth as you can to escape its gravitational field. So it's not really related to the speed of light. It's more related to the gravitational force that falls off at 1 over r squared.
Gravitational dilation, time dilation. You've used those words a number of times tonight, Roy. Is there a way you can define the word? I know you've got a good gut feel as to what it means. Can you define the dilation phenomenon in another set of words, making us a little bit more comfortable? Give that a try, you're right.
Well, it's kind of a difficult concept. So the way I tend to think of it is, like I said before, we all personally travel through time. It's all pretty much at the same rate in relation to each other. If we come in the influence of a very strong gravitational field or a very fast velocity from the frame of reference, then we tend to travel slightly slower through that time personally. The outside world is traveling at the ordinary rate. So we look up at the sky, everything's traveling a little bit faster because it's not being dilated by the gravitational field that we're feeling. The same with a high relativistic velocity. In high gravitational fields of a black hole, you get the same phenomena. As you approach the event horizon, time slows down for you, and it seems an eternity from the framework of people looking at you falling into the event horizon. So I don't know. It's not a simple concept, because we don't like to think of time being relative. We like to think of it as a rock-hard standard that doesn't change.
If my internal clock is going to run faster when I'm further away from the Earth, everything else being equal, does that mean I live longer on the surface of the Earth than I do in space?
No, no. Unfortunately, in your own perception, you carry your time with you. So you don't perceive, if you were to travel very fast in a rocket ship and then turn around and come back to the Earth, and if it took you, say, a year to do this, and very easily it could be 100 years in the future for you, but it's not going to feel like you've lived 100 years. Anyone who examines you is going to say, yeah, you seem to be 1 year older than 100 years ago. So it's your own personal time that counts. Your time sense doesn't change, just the environment may or may not change depending upon the frame of reference that the two are connected to. In the case of the rocket ship, it's two different frames of reference. Once you take off on that relativistic rocket, that's another frame of reference.
Assume that I am an identical twin, and my brother stays on the Earth. I go in space and dwell there for a long time, and then I come back. When me and my identical twin brother compare each other's age by some means, would we detect a difference?
Yes, depending upon the difference in the time dilation. Like I said before, there are all kinds of experimental constructs where a guy goes into a rocket ship and he comes back and it's 100 years in his future, although he only spent 1 year of his own personal lifetime. So in that case, his twin brother would be dead, his twin brother's children would be dead, his twin brother's great-great-grandchildren would be elderly. So yeah, he would notice the change.
It's not an easy one to swallow for some people. I'm one of them. I ran into a beautiful YouTube video for anybody who's interested in the James Webb Space Telescope. There is a very interesting person named Dr. Amber Straughn, Straughn. She's an astrophysicist at NASA, Goddard Space Flight Center, member of the James Webb Space Telescope Science Team. She's the Associate Director of the Astrophysics Division of Goddard, and she's also a member of the Goddard Space Telescope Science Institute. So when you go to her lecture that she gave in Canada in March of this year, she really gives you the inner story about James Webb. So by YouTube video, the easiest way to get to her is to go to YouTube video, let me drop, and do a search on her name, Dr. Amber Straughn. Amber, A-M-B-E-R, Straughn, S-T-R-A-U-G-H-N. And the fourth or fifth item that you get by that YouTube video search is her lecture at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Canada on March 1, 2017. Unfortunately, it's a 1 hour and 17 minute presentation she made. Very well done. Good illustrations and whatever. Gives you a lot of information about the James Webb Space Telescope. It's a lot easier to get to that website by way of that search. If you actually go to the URL itself, it's a very long URL, which I'm looking at, which has got upper and lower case and whatever. There's a zillion ways to get it wrong, but doing a search directly on her name will get you there, and I do recommend that. Okay.
Okay, I'm coming in.
Go right ahead, West.
The interesting fact is that during that year in space, in relativistic speed, the all components of the rocket, all of the transistors, all of the elements, all of the relays, will all go only 1 year. Sector Road.
So not only people slow down in their aging, you're saying even the hardware. See, that's the one way to make your transistorized radio last a lot longer, Roy. Go ahead.
I mean, that's one of the practical ways, theoretically, if you could go to near relativistic speeds for a human being to survive a long trip. The only problem is the people paying the bills will be long past dead, and people who pay the bills usually want to know the answer to the riddles and such. So if you tell these guys that the astronaut will be alive and well in 300 years when he comes back, but lots of luck with all you guys on the planet Earth, I don't think they'll pony up the $1 trillion. But yes, anything traveling at the relativistic velocities will all demonstrate the same exact time dilation. Everything in that rocket ship from top to bottom will only go 1 year into the future, as the rest of the local frame universe travels 100 years into the future.
Also, the percentage accumulated on your banking account from the money that you deposit after 200 years could be humongous.
Assuming that the bank doesn't fail, or that someone doesn't steal your money, or that there wasn't a revolution and all the money is worthless.
When you go in space that way, Roy, compared to the rest of the people on the Earth, you're aging more slowly. Are you aging more slowly because you're further away from the gravity field of the Earth, or because you're moving at a high velocity, or is it the combination? Over to you, Roy.
The overwhelming majority of the time dilation is due to the rocket's relativistic velocity. The time difference would be inconsequential. If you just kind of ran around Mars and Earth for 1 year and you came back, maybe the Earth would have experienced 1 year and 1 second, maybe.
So we have to move very close to the speed of light, which is very difficult. So to take advantage of this is going to be pretty difficult. Maybe it's time we go over to the space report. Over to you for a comment on that, Roy.
Yeah, I'm fine with it. Hopefully people will remember to send things. Again, mailbag@limarktech.net. You can ask physics questions. You can ask Dick amateur radio questions. You know, whatever you want to ask. Please, send your letters in. That's all I ask.
Okay. Paul, WS2N, what is NASA doing? What are they about to do next? And when you do get a chance to see this 1 hour presentation on the James Webb Space Telescope, I think you're going to really enjoy it. At least I did. Over to you, Roy. I mean, the Paul. WS2N, KQLAW.
I will definitely look into that. I wrote that down, Dick. Now, WS2N for the space report. This morning, an Antares Cygnus rocket took off from Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia, and it took off at 7:19 this morning. It was supposed to take off yesterday, and everything was good. Clear weather, cold, but they were good to go. Got down for 1 minute, and a private airplane decided to fly nearby to the northeast of the launch complex. So they did scrub for the day. But it got off this morning. I looked out my window. I really got to get to a better location for these wild silence launches. I didn't see a thing. But you should have been able to see the exhaust, the flame from the exhaust on the two RD-181 rockets that they're now using on the bottom of Antares. They changed out because a couple of years ago they were using NK-33 Russian rockets. Now they switched to the RD-181, also rocket Russian rocket engines. And they're much more powerful. They can carry a bigger load. They used to carry 4,000 pounds. This thing is 7,500 pounds of cargo. And the Cygnus spacecraft is now on the way to the International Space Station. They name each Cygnus spacecraft. This is the eighth one that's gone to the space station. They name each one after an astronaut that has passed. And in this case, this was named after Eugene Cernan, who just died not too long ago. So, looks like it's been successful. Liquid kerosene, liquid oxygen rocket for the booster. And then it gets into the second stage. Second stage is a solid booster. They call it a Coster 40-30 engine. It's a much more powerful one. Engine. They've upgraded them as the years have gone by. And it's a solid, fuel booster. And then that switches off. Bearings open up, releases the Cygnus spacecraft. And the Cygnus spacecraft has its own small rockets to finish the ride to dock with the space station 2 days from now. And they'll have that. They'll have that on TV when they do that on that TV. So that was pretty interesting. It's the whole rocket, the Antares rocket, is about 13 feet in diameter and maybe 130 feet, high. It's built by Orbital ATK, and so is the Cygnus spacecraft itself, also built by Orbital ATK, and the launch facilities are also maintained and operated by the same company. Soon to be merged with North, I believe they're going to be launched, North, Grumman, with another company, Lockheed Grumman, Northrop Grumman is now going to be part of Orbital ATK, so they'll be a bigger company, but they're doing very good work. They've got launches on the West Coast, here on the East Coast, and down in Florida now as well. Let me drop it. Okay, talking about people, astronauts that have passed away. Another one, we just lost Dick Gordon. Dick Gordon, originally from a Gemini flight, and then his next flight was on Apollo 12. Apollo 12 was the second manned flight to the moon. With him was Alan Bean and Pete Conrad. And Dick Gordon was the guy that stayed on the command ship while the LEM went down to the moon with Alan Bean and Pete Conrad. So he got to stay in orbit around the moon for over a day. Eventually, the docks linked up, and they all came back successfully. Shame to lose him, but he was, I think they said 88 years old. We'll keep losing people one by one. I think I reported back in a month or so ago about Paul White, who had just died. He was around 85. He was on the was on the first mission to the Skylab. So, another one gone. But, time marches on, so that I was looking through my list, and there's only, out of 24 people that actually went to the moon, they all didn't land on the moon, like Dick Gordon. But ones that went out to the moon, there's now only 10 left. So that's a shame. Some of these guys would like to see us go somewhere, if not Mars, maybe to maybe back to the moon. This guy had an interesting flight on Gemini 11. They did something that they don't even do today. The Russians were trying to do it, but they way back then, in the early 1960s. On 7-Eleven. They had to catch up with the Agena rocket. They launched Agena first, and then like an hour later, Gemini 11 took off, and within that, you know, actually less than one orbit, they caught up with the Agena and docked with it. Usually, you know, now it takes take 2 days. That's the regular number for, let's say, a Soyuz to catch up with the International Space Station. They managed to cut that down to around 6 orbits. And recently they tried to do it in half that time, except it didn't work. They had to work out. They had a scrub on the at the last minute. So years ago, I remember talking about Gemini 11 doing this, and people were saying, well, what's the big rush? Why don't they just launch Agena and then, you know, launch whenever it's directly overhead and catch up with it, you know, within a day or so. Well, first of all, in those days, the batteries would be running low on Agena. Agena didn't really have any solar panels. That's number one. But what they were really trying to duplicate, they were actually practicing duplicating a launch from the moon on the LEM. Eventually, all these six people, the six vehicles that did land on the moon with people, they all had to get back to the command module. They were duplicating what they had to do on the moon. When they would launch either Apollo 11, 12, or 14, 15, 16, or 17, they would launch within that one orbit. They would catch up with the command module and dock. So back then they knew that, and they were practicing for it. And that's the reason, that was the reason for that. Let me drop it. Okay. There's so many more different things that happened during the week. SpaceX, I talk about them a lot with their Falcon 9 engines. They're called, each engine is called a Merlin D, Merlin Delta engine. And, you know, there was an A and a C and a D. And each couple of years they've tried to upgrade these engines and the whole rocket itself. For instance, the rockets they're launching now are called Block 4, before that was Block 3. And they are increasing the thrust on these engines as one of the improvements. And in this case, they would have taken one of these Merlin D engines designed per booster, per first stage booster. Then there's another one all by itself on the second stage. But they were taking one and testing it in a rocket stand in McGregor, Texas. McGregor, Texas is the location where SpaceX does all their testing of the rocket experimentation. Well, these rockets, the Block 5 group, they call them, will be eventually the ones that will be launching people within a year or two from Florida, from Launch Complex 39A. So they were testing, they were just actually testing for leaks, and they were using oxygen to do that, passing oxygen through the engine. And the thing blew up and destroyed the whole launch stand in an area right next to it. So it's going to take probably a couple of 2 or 3 weeks to try to get that back to the way it was. The problem is I haven't read a report yet on what went wrong, why this thing blew up. And I'm wondering if it's going to cause any delays in the launching of, you know, some of these rockets that will be considered Block 5. Block 5, you know, there's other advances that are involved, such as the landing gear. These landing legs that come out, the four landing legs that come out on the rockets today, when they recover them, on a boat, or they come back to the land. Those legs, they don't really reuse. They take them apart, and that's it. These legs are going to be 100% reusable. They're just going to fold them back in, and it'll be ready to be launched again.
plus they're putting some kind of a heat shield, the next, some kind of a heat shield on, down by the rocket exhaust itself, you know, near the, you know, above the exhaust to protect the piping and all of that. A lot of that always has to be redone every time they land. This way, the heat shield is also reusable. They think Block 5 rockets will be able to be reused around 100 times each. For now, you know, the ones that have gone up, what I consider Block 4, they go up and land. They refurbish some of them, the ones that they can. So far, they've successfully relaunched 3 of these things out of, I think they've captured 19 so far. So they have a lot of storage, and out of that 19, 3 have been reused. But they're not going to be reusing those same 3 for a third time. These new rockets are going to be doing around 100 times each. So that's interesting, and that should bring the cost of space travel down. I talked about orbital ATK before launching Antares and Cygnus. They do other work as well. One of the things that they're now developing is the NGL, that's the next generation launch vehicle, to be launched down in Florida from 39B. 39A and 39B were the two launch pads that we use not only for Apollo's manned missions, but for the shuttle missions. You know, flew over half of them launch complex 39A, the other half launched from 39B. SpaceX has taken over 39A. Well, 39B is being rebuilt for the SLS, the Space Launch System, that NASA is building for their massive rocket. That's going to be the biggest rocket of all time, and will be manned, the manned rocket that carry the Orion spacecraft. That launch complex will probably be used maybe once a year. So orbital ATK wound up using the same launch complex when NASA's not using it to launch their future rocket. It's a massive rocket. It's probably 250 feet high, a little bit bigger than that maybe. All solid booster, solid segment system, 5 segments. And that will be orbital ATK's heavy lift vehicle. And for now, they have plans on using it for either NASA or for military use. And they have long-term plans of actually creating a manned space program using this particular rocket. It's derived from the original Ares mission. Ares 1 flew once. I'm going to see that. I still have that on tape. That was a test rocket that they had launched. But after that, they canceled the program because because of politics. They went from one administration to another. But they kept this design, and they just improved it a lot. And they're calling it for now, the NGL, Next Generation Launch Vehicle. So that should be ready for launch probably within about 4 years, that's my guess. But they're developing it now. There's already hardware being built for it. Okay. A few other things here. Blue Origin, they're getting ready to get their big massive rocket, probably almost as big as the Saturn V. That should fly. The earliest probably 2020, but they already have their building built now down in Florida. They've already started rebuilding Launch Complex 36 that they have taken over from NASA, and they'll be using that, and that will be a reusable rocket as well. That won't come back to land, but that will just land on an autonomous ship that they've already procured. They're starting to get that thing ready for a couple of years from, I guess, 3 years from now. A lot of things are going to be happening in the future. Right now, we're following all these unmanned flights, soon to be future flights. with people on board. Okay, one other thing that that came out, I think that was yesterday, it was a day ago, Sierra Nevada Corporation, SNC, a private company, you know, you can't buy the stock in it, but they're the ones that have been in the space business probably over three decades, doing all kinds of projects. They have equipment on satellites, they've been building rockets and stuff for NASA for decades. They're the ones building Dream Chaser. I talk about Dream Chaser a lot. Dream Chaser is the vehicle that kind of looks like a small shuttle, about 25% of the size, and that will be eventually going to the International Space Station for one, and that'll probably be 2021 in that time frame. The first test probably would be 2020, and that will be launched on an Atlas V rocket. The Dream Chaser is going to land on a runway. It looks like a shuttle, but it's going to take off on the Atlas V rocket. It's got the wings in the back that are going to be folded up so it fits inside the Atlas V rocket. That particular vehicle has been under development, I don't know, it's got to be 12, 13 years. Back in 2013, they tested it. They dropped it from a helicopter. Everything worked great. It was unmanned, and as it came in autonomously, it landed on the runway. But then they were using the wheels on the craft collapsed, and they wound up rolling over and causing some damage. It's been rebuilt ever since. The wheels knew everything, and they've been taking it for little rides in California, testing it with the truck pulling it. They took it the other day on a helicopter. They took it up in the air, made sure everything worked. They landed softly back on the ground with the helicopter. Now, just yesterday, I think it was, that they took the Dream Chaser up to I think around 4,000 feet and let it go from the helicopter, and it landed perfectly on the runway. This time it didn't roll over. They have better structural they changed everything underneath the vehicle to withstand the weight as it came down. But this thing will be able to eventually carry 12,000 pounds, more than all the other vehicles that go to the International Space Station. And I'd like to see this one eventually get up and running. So that's pretty much it. There's plenty of other news, but I'll turn it back to you, Dick. K2RIW. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report. Up to tank time.
Do we have anybody with any questions for Paul on the subject of space? Give me a call with us right now. You guys may or may not be aware that the Smithsonian is coming up with a series of movies that are all connected about Mars, and people are going to Mars to live there, to colonize Mars. The very first one was Before Mars, which is the story of a girl that's going to actually go there later on in her life, and you show her early life. So I think it's a series of at least five or so movies they've planned on roughly an hour each. And to colonize Mars, the little that I've seen, some of the material, they've got a lot of technical details about building a habitat, having the right kind of rocket to get there, and whatever, the right kind of hardware. However, let me drop this. As you've heard me say so many times before, when the Europeans decided to colonize the Americas, North and South America, when they went there, they didn't even have to worry about whether or not there would be soil, water, air, magnetic fields, Van Allen belt, all of these things to protect and provide. Mars is almost none of those. To go to Mars, you've got to worry about arrive, survive, and thrive, and also persist. And one of the things that we don't think about is that a human being requires a hell of a lot of energy, 130 watts of energy every 24/7. Your body is continuously metabolizing roughly 130 watts. And so raw food has to be put into you to provide that. Oxygen, water, and food. And the food that we eat, we are carnivorous. Half of what we eat is plants, and half of what we eat is animals. Let me drop. The plants, we know where they come from, the equivalent of a farm. Where do the animals come from? We're eating plants. So the real source of energy of the food is plants. That oak tree in your backyard may easily weigh 50 tons or 50,000 pounds at least. And the average person, if you ask them, where did that mass come from? They think it came from the soil. Not at all. I'll bet you more than 95% of it came from the air. The air provided the water that dripped down on it, and the air provided the carbon dioxide, the carbon. An awful lot of the tree is carbon. So the majority of the mass of the tree came from the air. The majority of the mass of material that goes into photosynthesis comes from the air. Okay? The Mars on air is, the air on Mars is 7/10 of the, of a 1%, 7/10 of 1% of the air pressure on Earth. So in order to grow plants on Mars, you have to supply air pressure. Otherwise the plant can't grow. And you have to apply sunlight. Mars is further from the sun, it's got less sunlight, and it has almost no air. So to provide the raw ingredients to grow the plants that are going to allow you to thrive and survive on Mars, the farming of plants on Mars is a very difficult problem. And I see no evidence that the people running the, making these movies for Smithsonian have taken that into account. When you see the movie The Martian, let me drop. Ben Affleck, I think is his name. Or was it, I can't think of the star's name. But in the movie The Martian, what's the star's name, Paul?
Matt Damien.
That's the one, Matt Damien. Matt Damien picked up some Martian soil, brought it into his habitat, and started planting potatoes. And he skipped over an awful lot of the problems of where did the carbon dioxide come from? Under the correct air pressure, with the sunlight. I mean, when you see the still pictures of the movie The Martian, you have the glass above him in his habitat that looks like an ordinary greenhouse. Air pressure at 14.7 pounds per square inch provides 2,000 pounds of force per square foot. His greenhouse didn't have anywhere near that strength to supply that air pressure to grow those plants, to have him survive. So, the food that's required to provide colonization of Mars, as I see it, is a huge problem. To find the water, to have the right kind of soil, to find the water, and to create the air pressure, and to create the sunlight to grow the plants. That's an extremely difficult problem that hasn't even been touched by any of these people who are making these movies. I wonder if you've seen any of these, if you go to the Smithsonian website, and you start looking at their movies about Mars. Very well done, except for these extremely significant details to me. WS2N, K2RIW. What have you seen any of those, Paul?
No, not by the Smithsonian, no, not yet. The National Geographic had a good series. I think it was around 6 or 7 shows last year, and they addressed that problem. I mean, they were way on the ground. Number one, to keep away from the radiation. Number two, to grow the all the stuff, and they had a big area they were growing all the stuff was being instead of sunlight they used lighting.
all kinds of LED lighting, and the power is being supplied, in this case, by nuclear. They weren't fooling around in the movie there. They had nuclear power and solar power, but mainly nuclear.
I hope I'm not confusing Smithsonian with National Geographic. The very first movie of that series that was done by National Geographic was one of them showing the life of the young girl that was going to become an astronaut later. It was called Before Mars. What were you up for?
No, they started off with, I don't know, I think there was about six of them going to Mars originally. And they had this rich guy, he was, I guess their version of Elon Musk, but he was European. The United States wasn't really involved in this movie. This was, you can tell it was not really, more or less a European Space Agency type of thing, but really done privately almost. And then they had one flight after another going up to Mars to build up their colony.
Okay, so maybe National Geographic and Smithsonian are doing this independently. And so, did you get the warm, fuzzy feeling in the National Geographic series on how they did agriculture? They were providing the light with light-emitting diodes. The power was coming from a nuclear power station. It wasn't coming from solar cells. And did they tell you how they provided the right amount of air pressure to run the plant? You have to continuously be taking the very tenuous atmosphere, selecting out the carbon dioxide, if it's not already a major component, and compressing it, and bringing it up to something like 14.7 pounds per square inch in order to grow the plants. You can grow plants at a lower air pressure, but I'm almost positive that they're going to grow at a slower rate, because it's the rate at which they can metabolize carbon dioxide, which is a function of air pressure, and the rate at which they can do photosynthesis on that. So you're going to have the right amount of light and the right amount of air pressure. Did they show you any of the details as to how they were pressurizing their greenhouse, so to speak? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, the whole complex was pressurized. You know, you had one cell after the other. They built, you know, it got bigger and bigger. And each cell was interconnected with these tunnels. And then eventually it got to the greenhouse area, and that was one big open area. So everything was pressurized. Everybody's running around in regular clothes. So the whole place was pressurized, including the greenhouse area. It didn't matter. You didn't have to have it. You didn't have to worry about the walls or anything being pushed out, because you didn't need glass. You know, everything was done with the LEDs. So there's no problem. But we do have to do something, and I mean, if not Mars, let's get to the moon, do something, because people are coming up, other countries are coming up faster than you can imagine. In a couple of months, beginning of next year, India is launching a lander and an orbiter to the moon. They've done one already. Wasn't a lander, but this one is going to have a lander, and after it lands, it's going to have a rover, and it's going to ride around for a couple of weeks. And here's India doing this. You know, they're launching it on GSPL, geosynchronous polar launch vehicle. GSL, they got four letters. GSLP, I think it is. GSLV, I think is what it's a big rocket, and you know they have a polar version, a little smaller, and they got some bigger ones, two big launch complexes in India. Now, imagine them doing it. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, everybody's parents would tell you, you know, eat your food, you know, people are starving.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Another planned Mars mission in another about a year. Back to you. All
WB2CLN, Portable 2.
WB2CLN, go right ahead. Start off with your name, sir.
Hey, name's Tom. Hello there, Paul. Hello, Dick. I know Dick from many years ago. Anyway, I'm up here in the Catskill Mountains. If you want to know what frigid is and nothing grows, it's up here. Oh, God, it's cold. Especially yesterday morning. Bad, 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 bad. Anyway, name's Tom once again. I'm on a cell phone. And you're talking about Mars. Hey, Elon Musk. Elon Musk has it all worked out, so don't worry about it. As far as growing stuff without an atmosphere, now, as I remember, that was done several years ago on the space shuttle. They grew crops in zero gravity. So, I don't know what you're worried about there. Go ahead.
Yeah, the zero gravity is not what I'm worried about. The average temperature on Mars is something like minus 50 degrees centigrade. Very, very cold. So you got to provide heat to grow the plants. You got to provide air pressure. I think the International Space Station runs at 14.7 pounds per square inch. You know how strong the walls and the air seals and airlocks have to be in order to maintain that air pressure room full. This movie that you saw by National Geographic of where they're growing plants under light-emitting diode power, powered by a nuclear power supply, did the structures have the kind of strength of the walls that you're familiar with the International Space Station? Was that shown in the movie? And in the case of Mars, as I said, you've got to create a tremendous amount of watts of heat, tremendous amount of pounds of air pressure. You have to be continuously compressing the outside air in order to supply the carbon dioxide that the plant consumes. So, do you believe National Geographic gave you some of those details of strength of wall, compression of air, heating, and whatever? Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
No details, but you know, the assumption is made that these things are all interconnected. They just show you a rough diagram of all the different cells that were landed there and that they were interconnected with these tunnels. You have to assume that the garden area was the same thing. I agree with Tom. Elon Musk is going to have us on Mars before NASA. The way he's going, he's really doing good. And another thing Tom said was the shuttle. The shuttle tried to grow some flower or two, but International Space Station has the veggie program. They call it the veggie program. So there's a whole big tray area that they've been growing stuff the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years now. And they've been growing salads and actually eating them on board, you know. And now they bought up a bigger unit to be installed in the Kaibo module, which is an even bigger module than where it is, where it's located now in Destiny. And they'll be growing, I think, three different crops at a time instead of one at a time that they're doing now. And then after that, they're going to work on five at a time. So they're getting there, slowly but surely. But, you know, hey, we got time. You know, we know it's going to take a long time to get to Mars. We drop it. Presently, under this administration, I think we're heading back to the moon again. It keeps switching from administration to administration. In the Bush administration, we had the Constellation program. We were on the way to the moon. That was it. Obama got in there. No, not good enough. We're going to Mars. And everything was, you know, gung-ho to Mars. The SLS program. And, I mean, nothing, you know, the SLS program is not going to be canceled. They're just going to utilize everything that they've been building. But I think we're heading back to the moon first as a stepping stone. And then they're going to build a deep gate, deep space gateway around the moon. Essentially a small international space station going around the moon. And it will be international. And then from there out to the
out to Mars. Dick, back to you, WS.
I'll admit that Elon Musk is using some very good ideas and making things a lot less expensive by way of recovering rockets, sending them back to Earth, and so on. He's made it a lot cheaper. Let's assume that he's made it cheaper by 10 to 1. The Apollo mission program to get man to the moon was over $30 billion in 1970 money, $30 billion. Even if I make that 10 to 1 cheaper, $3 billion to get to the moon, is a rough guess. In 1970 money, use the inflation over those 40 years, and it's a lot more expensive. Mars is 1,000 times further away than the moon. Some people being pessimistic are going to say it's going to cost 1,000 times more than going to the moon. I know we're into multiple trillions of dollars to get a human being or a couple of human beings to Mars. Who's going to pay for that? It's going to take the contribution of multiple nations to do it. The United States is not going to do that alone. And many of those nations are going to say, if I give you 10% of my gross national product to get astronauts on Mars, what do I get in return for that? They're going to ask that question. So just the sheer cost and the sheer risk and the sheer difficulty, I see an awful lot of problems. Maybe I'm being overly pessimistic. We've almost used up our time. This was TechNet number 1676. That was Space Report number 276. Be kind to each other. We'll be back next week. We'll send it over to Roy and then to Paul to tie on the ribbons. RS AC2GS K2LIW. Go ahead.
Repeater. Time out.
Thank you, Dick. AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. That was a fun time, and everyone keep in mind mailbag@limartech.net. Again, mailbag@limartech.net. Someone tested it out to make sure that it works, and it works. So hopefully some questions for next week, or I really will tell you about the Higgs boson. So over to Paul.
That's okay. We have the physics forum. That sounds good to me. So I haven't come up with a formal name, but that sounds good. We'll be back next week, 73, guys. Have a good night, Roy, Dick, everybody else. We'll look for more flights coming up. I know there's a couple more coming, but I've run out of time. 73, WS23.
Yeah, if I can grab it here, WB2CLN. Well, I agree it's a bit of a pep talk about going to Mars, from what I hear. The details have not been worked out. Only Arnold Schwarzenegger was there. And Total Recall, aye. But, It's a tall order. But I remember that you can buy a ticket for a travel to the moon, not to land on it, by Elon Musk. You can buy a round trip. I think it's round trip. I don't know. It's not one way. A round trip. Going around the moon, I forgot the price, but I believe it's available now.
Okay, Tom, the repeater's going to shut down. It usually shuts down around 12, so if we don't come back to you without being rude, the machine's going to quit. Go on, Arnold. 73 WS, gun clear.
Would you buy one of those tickets, Paul?
as long as I'm going to come back, yeah, sure. But I got to get to a time machine first and make myself about 40 years younger.
If you could afford it right now, would you go?
No. Because
I'd have to be 20 years. You got to be 20, 25 years old.
Tom, if you could afford it, would you go?
Would I go? What are you, crazy? No.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Why not?
Well, how much is it? I think it's $100,000.
12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Tonight at 8:30, W2VL repeater system.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Tonight at 8:30, welcome to the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Tonight at 8:30, W2VL repeater system.